WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, rebuilding Jewish communities in Poland. We talk with Rabbi Michael Shudryk, a native New Yorker who moved to Warsaw in 1990. Jewish life all but disappeared from Poland after the Holocaust and four decades of communist rule. Shudryk is working to help Polish Jews reconnect with their heritage and restore Jewish culture and religious practice. Also, writer-director Mike White, whose films include Nacho Libre and School of Rock. His new film, Year of the Dog, is about adults obsessed with their pets. It stars Molly Shannon and Peter Sarsgaard. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in this week for Terry Gross. My guest, Rabbi Michael Shudryk, has spent much of his career working to revive a once-thriving culture that all but vanished decades ago, the Jewish community of Poland. Poland was for centuries the closest thing to a Jewish homeland in Europe. Before the Second World War, the country was home to 3.5 million Jews. They were 10% of Poland's population and represented a fourth or more of the inhabitants of its largest cities. But the German invasion in 1939 made Poland a center of extermination for European Jews. Most of the Nazi death camps were located there. Soon after the fall of communism in 1989, Michael Shudryk moved to Warsaw on behalf of the Ronald S. Lauder Foundation, which seeks to rebuild Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. Shudryk has spent most of the last 17 years in Poland, working to revive religious practice and build Jewish cultural institutions. Though he grew up in New York, Shudryk is now the chief rabbi of Poland. I spoke to him last week. Well, Michael Shudryk, welcome to Fresh Air. What was left of the Jewish community in Poland as the war ended?
1939, 3.5 million Jews. By the end of 1944, 90% of those 3.5 million Jews are no longer alive, murdered by the German Nazi regime. It still leaves, after World War II, 10% alive. 10% of 3.5 million is 350,000 Jews still alive in Poland at the end of the war. Many had survived by fleeing into the Soviet Union, returning to Poland in the years just after the war. But most of those Jews realized rather quickly that they needed to make a choice. If they wanted to maintain their Jewish identity, it made sense to leave Poland. Poland, which became a communist country, Poland, which had horrible memories for them inflicted by the German occupiers, and also too much anti-Semitism. Still, as before the war, there was anti-Semitism. After the war, there was anti-Semitism. And so it led to the realization of Jewish survivors that if you want to maintain your Jewish identity, it makes sense to leave Poland. And the vast majority left. But some stayed. And those who stayed agreed with those who left that if I want to stay Jewish, I should leave Poland. But if I want to stay in Poland, I should then leave being Jewish. And because of the communist regime and because of some element of anti-Semitism in Poland, some tens of thousands of Jews stayed, but no longer maintained their Jewish identity, to the extent that they often never even told their children or grandchildren. So you had a couple hundred thousand survivors that left over 25 years, and some thousands, tens of thousands that stayed, many of them giving up their Jewish identity. And only in 1989, with the collapse of the communist system, did these hidden Jewish survivors begin to tell their children, their grandchildren, that, you know something? I was once a Jew. And so the story of the contemporary Jewish community today is really about one of discovery.
When you went in 1990, I gather a lot of people were just beginning to discover that they were Jewish or ask the question, might I be Jewish? And I'm curious sort of what prompted people to ask those questions and what sort of stories and experiences did you note among those who were seeking their heritage?
Every person is an individual case. But I'll tell you one story. There's a young woman that came to me when she was 17, and she told me that she asked me, am I Jewish? She says, my mother's 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 mother was Jewish. And she was the last one in my family that actually was actively Jewish. And my grandmother told my mother, when grandma was on her deathbed, that before I die, I want you to know, my daughter, that my mother's mother was a Jew. And then grandma died. Mom waited a couple of years to tell me till I was 16. She told me. I became curious. I found somebody in my high school who was Jewish. I said, what do you do? And she said, we go to the Lauder camp. And then she told me that, and that she came to the Lauder camp, at the end of the camp, that she felt something come alive in her she never felt before.
Now, explain what you mean by the Lauder camp.
It was a summer program that we ran for exactly these kinds of people, Poles who were discovering their Jewish roots, who were interested in learning more. In other words, we're very, very important principle is non-coercive. If someone discovers they're Jewish but says, hey, that no longer speaks to me, that's not who I am, that's their decision. And they have the right to make that decision. But if somebody says, hey, you know, I want to learn something about it, then we have created a spectrum of programs that give these people a chance to be able to taste, to learn, to experience, to be inspired by by Jewish tradition, by Jewish culture. And so this young woman said she came to the Lauder camp, and she said she felt something come alive her she never felt before. And as a rabbi, I could say that we call that as the spark of the Jewish soul. That what is really going on in Poland today is something fundamentally very spiritual. It's people looking for something that they realized was missing in their lives. When they discover that they're Jewish, they realize that there's this spiritual void they've always felt, and now they want to look to fill it. Which is interesting because it leads people to a more traditional practice often, not always, but often, than you may find in the United States.
I read that some people are inclined to inquire about their heritage if they discover that they have many, many ancestors who are dead, and no one's ever explained why. Is that right?
Right. If one wants to understand in one little short sentence the impact of the Holocaust, is that one of the ways people realize that they have Jewish roots is when grandma has no living relatives. While Poles suffered and were killed during the war by Nazis, 3 million non-Jewish Poles were killed. It wasn't 90%. And so when you realize that grandma or dad has no living relatives, that's usually a very strong indication that they're really Jewish.
When one goes to a service, I gather there are services in several Polish cities now.
Yes.
What's the age of the people participating?
Okay. I am 51 years old. In the daily service in Warsaw, I'm usually the oldest person. The average age is probably the median age is probably 32, 33. That's true for Warsaw. It's true in Łódź, in Lodz, it's probably 45. In Krakow, it's older. In Wrocław, it's somewhere in the middle. But as things grow, what we're finding is that the younger and younger people are coming. On a normal Shabbat, Saturday morning in Warsaw, we'll have, without any of the visitors, we'll have 70 to 80, 90 of our own people, probably about 15 people under the age of 13.
You know, as a Jewish community has begun to emerge in Poland, I wonder what your sense is of to what extent Jews and Catholics in the country have come to some common understanding of what happened in the Holocaust. I mean, Polish, non-Jewish Poles consider themselves, you know, in some ways among the most, the victims of the war who suffered the most, 3 million dead, you know, at the hands of the Nazis. But, you know, some have seen them as willing collaborators or themselves instigators of terrible anti-Semitic violence. And I'm wondering to what extent, as the Jewish community has emerged, that discussion has been generated and what it's produced.
You're really touching upon something that is very important and also very sensitive. Part of the problem stems from the fact that there was no normal, natural contact between Poles and Jews for 50 years, between 39 and 89. There were some contacts, but kind of in an open, ongoing, normal way. That very old, nearly 1,000-year relationship, with its positive and its negative side, But for 1,000 years, until 1939, Poles and Jews had an animated relationship. Sometimes better, sometimes worse, but it was a real day-to-day living relationship. And whatever the problems were real. There was nothing abstract about it. And since 1989, we're struggling, both Jews and Poles, kind of struggling to find how to restart that relationship, how to restart that dialogue, which was not always good, which had its problems, also had its good times, had its good points. And since, considering it's only 1989, only 18 years ago, incredible, incredible changes to the positive. Poles are now much more open to understanding that that the Jewish suffering cannot be compared to the Polish suffering. That as horrible and painful as it is for a Pole to hear this, there were Poles who collaborated. And that's something that Poland is beginning and has made significant steps in recognizing. It doesn't mean it's universal. It doesn't mean everybody does. On the other hand, Jews have begun to realize that Poles also suffered during the war. I, as a young person, as a child, even in my university years, don't remember learning that 3 million non-Jewish Poles, that number today is questioned, it may be not quite that big, but a significant number of non-Jewish Poles were murdered during World War II. I didn't know that. And so more Jews are becoming aware of the fact that there's a sensitivity to the suffering of the Poles. We're not playing a comparative game here. From the historical aspect, there is no comparison. 90% Polish Jews murdered by German Nazis and collaborators. 3 million Jews out of the 6 million. But yet, that doesn't mean that we Jews also don't need to be sensitive to another nation that lost 3 million fathers and mothers and sons and daughters.
We're speaking with Michael Szudryk, the chief rabbi of Poland. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Michael Szudryk. He's an American rabbi who spent much of the last 17 years in Poland, working to rebuild a Jewish community that had all but disappeared after the Holocaust and 44 years of communist rule. There was an incident last May which has gotten a lot of attention, where you were, I think, walking near a synagogue, maybe on your way to services, and you were
on your way back from services.
On your way back from services, and you were insulted and attacked by an anti-Semitic man. What happened?
Okay. So it was on a beautiful sunny May afternoon, walking after services. I was walking with five young people in their 20s and 30s and two little kids, 5 and 7 years old. And a man, also I thought he was in his 20s. It turns out he was in his 30s, yelled at us, "Poles for Poland." It was a well-known anti-Semitic pre-World War II slogan, which the whole slogan is, "Poles for Poland, Jews to Palestine," meaning Jews get out of Poland. And I've heard such things before, once, twice a year. And when I do hear them, if the situation is right, I confront the person because I see no reason to ignore it and I see no reason to run away. So I confronted him and I said, "Why do you say that?" And for the first time, and I've been in Poland a fairly long time since 1990, for the first time, rather than responding verbally, he hit me. And I responded, as I like to say, went into New York mode, and I hit him back. I don't know why I did that, but I have to say that is certainly one very appropriate response when somebody hits you. Hit him back, at which point he had pepper spray and sprayed me in my face, started to run, and I chased after him. He ran faster than I did, which is probably a good thing, because I have no idea what I would have done if I would have caught him. And as serendipity would have it, it happened at a very interesting juncture in the year, because the next day, Pope Benedict the 16th was going to Auschwitz. Here is this German pope going to Auschwitz, an incredibly important, moving experience. And the day before, the chief rabbi gets attacked in Warsaw by an anti-Semite, by a Polish anti-Semite. So there was a tremendous sensitivity. And in a very meaningful way, an important way, the government took it very seriously, very quickly. They actually caught the guy, which is very hard to do. Was served 2 months in jail and then received a 2-year suspended sentence. I don't know anywhere else in the world that somebody got 2 months for pepper spraying somebody in the face. And more importantly, it was the response of the leadership of Poland. The prime minister called me immediately after Shabbat and said, "What happened? Are you okay? What can we do?" The president invited me on the following Monday to the presidential palace to make a very public statement in front of the Polish news media. And it wasn't the world media. It was the Polish media saying, "This is unacceptable in Poland today." And this is what I've really heard from successive Polish governments since 1989. Anti-Semitism today is unacceptable.
You know, I wonder if your response got as much attention. It sounds like the attack itself was really what was really the focus of all of the attention of it. But your response of fighting back struck me as interesting, and I wondered if you or others saw it as kind of a message or a metaphor of fighting back, not being passive in this place where millions, you know, had suffered extermination of in a different generation.
It's very hard to comment on myself. The reality is, in the moment of when it happens, you're working not on intellectual level. You're working on certain things that are so primal inside of you that they just come out without even thinking. And I have a real allergy at people hitting me. And it's clearly my response, having grown up in a fully democratic, pluralistic society here in the United States, that when somebody does that to me, I respond in the way that he has attacked me. And if he hits me, I'll hit him back. And even the truth is, when I saw him later in a police lineup, I took a look at him and I said, "This guy is like a lot bigger than I am." And I said, "Did I really hit that guy back?" And I don't know why I did it, but I guess it is in a... I know why I approached him. I don't know why I hit him, but I do know why I confronted him verbally, is that too many good people are silent. The problem never in society never is the evil person, because society is always going to have evil. I don't know why, but it does. The problem or the collapse of society happens is when the good are silent. And so very much I try to live my life and to teach my community that when you see something wrong, you have to react. You have to speak out, and at times, even to punch back.
You know, you've devoted a good part of your career to rebuilding the Jewish community in Poland, and I wonder, is that mission a matter of making it safe to be Jewish in Poland and building a vibrant community there, or is all part of it also a statement to the world to reconstitute a presence in what really was, for centuries, the Jewish homeland of Europe?
No. For me, the most important thing is the individual person. This person has been denied access, information about something that is in his past, the Jewish part of his past. And so my first goal really is, even before rebuilding a Jewish community, is rebuilding Jews. Giving these Poles with Jewish roots a chance to find out what it means to be Jewish. And along the way also, I have a great amount of affection now for Poland. I know a lot of Jews find that strange, but I've seen a part of Poland which unfortunately many Jews have never had the chance to see, and that is this part of Poland that wants to be pluralistic, is pluralistic, treasures the fact that Jews played such an important part in Poland. And that may seem to be heresy to some, but there are such Poles out there. And while we need to identify and always fight anti-Semitism, and I think that from what I did last year, I certainly think no one's going to argue that I do that. But on the other hand, if we only identify anti-Semitism and we fail to nurture, to support, to empower those natural allies that want to also fight anti-Semitism within the Polish community and want to preserve Jewish culture and tradition, then we're making a huge mistake.
People who weren't aware of their Jewish heritage for years, even decades, probably held a lot of stereotypes about Jews. And I'm wondering, when they discovered that they were in fact Jewish, was there a weird thing where they felt compelled maybe to embrace a stereotypical view of what a Jew was?
It's very varied. I mean, I could share with you very quickly one story, which is probably the most unusual of all the stories. There's a young couple, and now they're now 30 years old. They met and fell in love in high school. They got married right out of high school. When she was 20, she discovered she had Jewish roots, but it didn't mean anything to her. At 23, she decided she wanted to do something Jewish. She decided every Friday night she's going to make a Shabbat dinner. And her husband went along with her. He said, okay, sure, why not? His parents got very upset. You can't let your wife do Jewish things. Don't. It's ridiculous, stupid. Don't let her do it. And the more they pushed on their son to be against his wife, the more he supported his wife. And finally, the parents admitted to the son, why were they against him, his wife doing Jewish things? It's because they were both Jewish. So it turns out he's Jewish, she's Jewish, the two little kids are Jewish. The interesting part of the story is that when they fell in love in high school, they were both skinheads. So it's very romantic. Two Polish skinheads fall in love, get married, and then one after the other discover that they're Jewish and today are observant, very observant, very active members of the Jewish community of Warsaw. As a matter of fact, I have a title for the book not yet to be written, or the book yet to be written, and that is From Skinheads to Covered Heads. And so you can imagine the changes, the challenges. As a matter of fact, this young guy was very sensitive, said to me about a year ago, said, you know, sometimes, Rabbi, sometimes I get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and can't believe that it's me. And so there are all kinds of issues, and including people who had anti-Semitic feelings about Jews discovering that they're really Jewish.
Wow, that's quite a journey. Well, Rabbi Michael Shudrick, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
My pleasure.
Rabbi Michael Shudrick is the chief rabbi of Poland. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, making offbeat comedies about a manic rocker teaching at a prep school, a monastery cook who takes up a secret life as a wrestler, and now about adults obsessed with their pets. We talk with writer-director Mike White. His films include Nacho Libre, School of Rock, and the new film, Year of the Dog. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Mike White is an actor and writer whose best-known work is the Jack Black film School of Rock, which he wrote and appeared in as Ned Schneebly, Jack's timid roommate. White's other screenplays include The Good Girl, Nacho Libre, Orange County, and Chuck and Buck, which he also starred in. White's also written episodes of several TV series, including Freaks and Geeks and Dawson's Creek. Now Mike White has made his directorial debut with Year of the Dog, a new film he wrote starring Molly Shannon, Peter Sarsgaard, John C. Reilly, and Laura Dern. Shannon plays Peggy, a single office worker whose closest relationship is with her pet beagle, Pencil. That is, until he dies unexpectedly. She's crushed by the loss of her companion, so a neighbor she's barely spoken to before, played by John C. Reilly, asks her out to dinner. Here they are at a restaurant.
So you were saying you had a dog who died when you were young?
Tessie, I love that dog. I had her since she was a puppy. We did everything together. She was my right-hand bitch. Sorry, I mean, in the dog way of being a bitch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she died way too young. She was only 6.
Oh.
Yeah.
How did she die?
I shot her in Wyoming. You want some more wine?
Wait, what do you mean?
It was an accident. A hunting accident.
Oh.
I still feel terrible.
What were you hunting?
Hunting moose. Mooses. They got a lot of moose up there. Don't worry about it. You ever been hunting?
No.
Can be a rush. But, you know, accidents do happen. And, a gun is a very powerful weapon. I learned that the hard way. That's why I never keep guns in my house.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. Just knives.
Well, Mike White, welcome back to Fresh Air. Molly Shannon is at the center of this story. Is it true that you wrote this script with her in mind?
Yeah. I had the inspiration for the movie was I had, was doing this TV series for Fox. It was a half-hour sitcom with Molly and Jason Schwartzman called Cracking Up that was like a short-lived disaster. And it was one of those things where, like, just constant fighting with the network, never a moment of peace, just one of those really bad professional experiences. And I was just sort of overstressed and underslept, and over the Christmas breaks where sometimes you try to catch up on scripts, I had this stray cat who lived behind my house who sort of unexpectedly died on me one day. It was like on Christmas Day, actually. And I didn't even know I was that attached to the cat, but I was so sort of emotionally kind of unhinged by this cat dying. And I ended up writing the like most depressing half hour of that show. And the network hated more than the other stuff I had already been doing, and ended up getting even more behind. And it was just like basically the show shut down. And I really think if that cat hadn't died, it wouldn't have had such a sort of profoundly depressing end. And when the dust settled on it, I looked back and I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting life experience. And you know, the thing was, one thing I'd gotten was I just had such a great time with Molly. I just felt like it's like, you know, when you make a movie or you have a TV series, you feel like you're throwing a party and you invite all these people to your party and you tell them it's going to be fun. And then it turns out not to be fun and it just goes on forever. And it was just one of those things where I was like, I'd like to throw a party for Molly where it actually was fun and we had a good time and it turned out good.
Right. So the story kind of revolves around people, adults who are in some ways obsessed with their pets. Was there something about that idea that connected to Molly Shannon?
Well, not so much the pets, but I do think that like there's just sort of an innocence about Peggy and a sweetness. And the thing about Molly is she's kind of preternaturally like positive. There's just something like she just has like she's just such a kind, like she's so giving as just in communication and in life. And I just thought, you know, people think of her as like the girl who's like sniffing her armpits and falling over bleacher chairs from Saturday Night Live. And
right.
I just, you know, it's like there's such a sweet warmth to Molly. And I just wanted to create a character that she got to show some of those colors to.
Well, I think she is terrific in the role. And I thought maybe we would share with the audience a moment from the film. This is where this is after she's had the experience of a pet dying, and she ends up going out on for dinner with her next door neighbor, who's a regular guy played by John C. Reilly. And in this scene, they've just come back from dinner, and they're sitting in the front seat of John C. Reilly's truck, and this conversation ensues.
Thank you. I had a nice time.
So you ever been married?
No. I mean, I was, I had boyfriends, but I never, you know, I guess I never, that never happened, but, you know, I think some people just aren't as, you know, I don't even know what I'm saying, just, you know, whatever, you know, what are you gonna do? And the whole dating thing is just kind of yuck, no thank you, so... Yeah, so, I don't know, that's basically how I feel. Just, I don't know. It's like that.
And that's Molly Shannon and John C. Reilly in the film Year of the Dog, written and directed by my guest, Mike White. You know, I love the way she delivers that, and I wondered how much of that is written and how much of that is improvised?
Well, it feels like I'm patting myself on the back, but it was weird that Molly actually memorized all of those ramblings that were on the page. It was like oddly exactly. I mean, she did it her way, but it was not improvised. It was, I tried to do my best version of a stuttering, muttering fool.
You've of course written a lot of movies and you've acted in movies. This is the first time you've directed one, and I'm wondering what the experience was like. Whereas in the past, you've come up with the words, but then it's someone else's interpretation that gets on screen. What was it like to run it, to be in control?
Well, it's, you know, the truth is that I've had really great experiences with directors and have been able to be, since I've acted in some of the movies I've been in, you know, to be able to be a part of the production. And I've never really had the experience where I mean, at least in the features that I've done, where I go... Oh gosh, they blew it in the interpretation. I've always felt like they were pretty uncharacteristically close to the script. You know, for screenwriters, usually they get frustrated by that. But it definitely, after a while, you become a backseat driver anyway. You know, you just become more and more of a, like, you know, you a hand wringer, and it you start to irritate yourself
as a writer. You
so,
mean.
It's just as like the person on the set who's like, you know, going, well, you know, like, you know, trying to put your two cents in and knowing when the right time is. And, you know, like, you sort of end up feeling like you're passive aggressively manipulating everybody to try to do it the way you want them to. And that ends up becoming more stressful than actually directing. Being able to just go over and say, well, why don't you try it this way or whatever, and not feeling like, you know, is this my role or am I stepping on somebody's toes? It was actually made it a lot less stressful for whatever reason.
Our guest is Mike White. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is actor, writer, and now director Mike White. His new film is Year of the Dog. You know, you've covered a lot of different subject areas when I look at the body of work that you've written. But it seems that a lot of your central characters are sort of on the fringe of worlds they inhabit, sort of restless, dissatisfied people. Were you like that growing up?
Well, I definitely relate to somebody who feels like their interests or their persona or whatever is somehow outside of the mainstream, and that the sort of conventional world is something that they feel slightly alienated from. And so I tend to like to write characters that kind of, you know, whether by their passion or their goals or who they are, sort of are subverting the status quo or the world they're in.
Right. Now, you went to Wesleyan University and were lucky enough to get writing work in Hollywood pretty quickly, did a lot of television work. And then in 2000, you wrote and started in Chuck and Buck, which is this film where you play Buck, this guy in his 20s who's sort of has the social development of a 12-year-old and who's trying to reconnect with his childhood friend, Chuck. And here is a scene where Buck, who's the kind of socially studded guy, visits Chuck in his office. I think we have a clip.
After you left, I didn't really get into school at all, you know. I didn't like the other kids so much. All the homework and sports just wasn't fun. It's weird you have this office. What are you doing here?
Sign bands and produce and negotiate contracts. It's not all that interesting.
That's funny. That's really funny. Because you remember we used to play games like we were businessmen. Remember we bought all those office supplies? And now you're like really doing it. Is it real now or is it still like a game?
It's pretty real.
And that's my guest, Mike White, along with Chris Weitz in the film Chuck and Buck, which Mike White wrote and starred in. You know, in this film, Chuck, the kind of more socially stunted of the two, is sexually attracted to his old friend, but kind of sees sex as an adolescent does, and he sort of becomes a stalker. What's interesting about this film, I know that you didn't direct it and didn't do the casting, but you ended up playing the lead, and you inhabit this role so completely convincingly that I wonder if it sort of followed you and people assume it's in some way autobiographical.
Well, I did get a lot of that when the movie first came out, and you know, certainly the first, it was a weird thing to, you know, have your first movie and be in it and be sort of recognized to be that character and have all of those sort of, I don't know, assumptions or questions that come with that. But, you know, in a way, it was a really creatively liberating, because when you have, once you kind of like jump out of the airplane and have that kind of real sense of just like, gosh, you know, all these people either think I'm crazy or I'm this character. It just sort of like you realize you can't control that, and you know, you'll never win the popularity contest in a sense. So you can kind of just give up that goal and just kind of pursue the stuff that makes it, you know, that's meaningful to you.
Did it open doors for you, this film?
Yeah, weirdly. I mean, it was like one of those movies that, like, when I wrote it, you know, and said I was going to make it, I mean, people would read the script and say, not only do I not want to, like, you know, give you the money to make this, but I think you really shouldn't make this. Don't make this movie kind of thing. So it was interesting that when you actually, you know, once it was made and we put it out there, that, you know, it was a movie that, you know, kind of seems to have stuck around. And certainly it did open doors for me in terms of, you know, people, you know, screenwriters suffer from anonymity, I think, in a sense. And whether, even if, like, you know, people think maybe I'm a crazy stalker, at least they recognize me and can identify me with the work that I do. And that has certainly been helpful in some sense in this
right.
business.
A lot of people know your film, School of Rock, which you also wrote, and which stars Jack Black as this out-of-work rock musician who, desperate for money, gets a gig as a substitute teacher in a private school and then kind of uses the kids to create a rock band, which he can star in. Where did that idea come from?
Well, I was living next door to Jack for a few years and became friendly with him, and sometimes he would give me scripts that people, you know, that had been offered to him. And you know, I wasn't really in the big sort of comedy rewrite world or whatever, but I kept reading these scripts and I was like, you know, I could write something for him that would be more appealing potentially than these scripts that he's giving to me. There's something so winning about Jack. And up to that point, it felt like he was really just getting the parts of like the like drunk frat guy or, you know, who's falling through windows or whatever. I just thought it would be fun to kind of make a movie with him with kids and try to like open up his audience base and try to do something that's sweeter.
Well, it really worked. Let's hear a clip from School of Rock. This is Jack Black, where he's has his students who he's making into, who he's crafting, molding into a rock band, and here's where he's explaining to them the nature of rock and roll.
You guys been doing real good in here. And if I was gonna give you a grade, I would give you an A. But that's the problem. Rock ain't about doing things perfect. Who can tell me what it's really about? Frankie.
Scoring chicks?
No. See? No. Eleni?
Getting wasted.
No. Come on. No. Leonard.
Sticking it to the man?
Yes. But you can't just say it, man. You gotta feel it in your blood and guts. If you wanna rock, you gotta break the rules. You gotta get mad at the man. And right now, I'm the man. That's right. I'm the man. And who's got the guts to tell me off? Huh? Who's gonna tell me off?
Shut the hell up, Schneebly.
That's it, Freddy. That's it. Who can top him?
Get out of here, stupid ass.
Yes, Alicia.
You're a joke. You're the worst teacher I've ever had.
Summer, that is great. I like the delivery because I felt your anger.
Thank you.
You're a fat loser and you have body odor.
All right. All right.
And that is Jack Black from School of Rock, written by my guest, Mike White. It's just so much fun to watch Jack Black in this role. It's sort of hard to imagine anybody else having done it. Were there certain mannerisms or certain styles he had that you wanted to get into this character?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it was just like with Molly, it was like I really wrote something specifically for him. And, you know, I knew he was going to bring a lot of his own stuff to it. But I tried to write something that was as much in his voice and, you know, with his mannerisms as I had observed in my time living next door to him. He just, you know, the thing about Jack, and I find that's true about Molly and certain people that are, you know, at the highest level of, you know, comedy, that they just are funny. Like, I don't think Jack has ever left a message on my machine that wasn't humorous. And I don't think it's not necessarily that he's always on or trying really hard. There's just something sort of funny about the way he, you know, words come out of his mouth. And so that makes it easier to write comedy when you know, you have somebody who can just kind of sell it.
Now, you also had kids in this, which were a critical element of it working. How did you picture the kids in School of Rock? I mean, it's not quite Fame, not quite Bad News Bears.
Well, I felt like it's like you needed, with Jack, you need somebody who's like crashing the sort of the party. So that in a sense that I felt like it was important to like make the kids in a more sort of, you know, uptight, you know, very academic and competitive school, because it felt like that then he would really be the fish out of water in that world. So, and I had gone to a school growing up that was pretty rigorous and similar to the school in School of Rock. But Rick Linklater really deserves the credit for finding these kids, especially the ones that were in the band. It was really important to him to find kids that really played that music and could perform, so it didn't feel like some cheesy, you know, like some cheesy TV show where everybody's lip syncing in the big finale.
Right. You know, a colleague of mine at the Philadelphia Daily News said that movie was like a life-altering experience for his kids who were playing music and really got into classic rock after that. I mean, was there any kind of mission here? I'm wondering, did you have any particular relationship to rock and roll that informed this idea?
I mean, for me, it's more the creative impulse. I mean, I went to a school that was very sort of like focused on the mathematics and the sciences and, you know, very preparatory. And I was this sort of creative person and felt like like that part of my education wasn't as much focused on, and had sort of wished it had been. And so whether it was rock music or, you know, writing or just anything that was more creative, it was what I was kind of trying to do, was talk about, you know. And, you know, the thing is, when I was a kid and watched movies, I would come home and sort of reenact the movie, especially if something that really caught my inspiration. And so there was a part of me that was writing to that kid in me, which was sort of saying, you know, go out and do it, you know, like just a sort of call to you know, follow your creative impulses.
Now, I know you also grew up in a conservative Christian home. I mean, did that make it harder to explore creative stuff?
I mean, not so much. I mean, my dad was in a he was a minister, and he came from a really conservative Christian background. But he was a filmmaker and a writer, so it wasn't so much that, you know, my parents were squashing that creative impulse at all. But so much. It does actually affect the fact that, like, I don't have a very long sort of rock musical education, because, you know, we had sort of more, you know, gospel and Christian music in our house, and so I think people think, well, since I've written School of Rock, that I'm some sort of rock aficionado, and there's actually huge gaps in my rock education.
My guest is Mike White, and we'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining me. My guest is actor, writer, and director Mike White. His new film is Year of the Dog. After School of Rock, you did another film with Jack Black that was a vehicle for his energy, called Nacho Libre, where he plays Ignacio, who is a cook in a monastery that's raising orphans in Mexico, and then decides to adopt a secret life as a wrestler in the Lucha Libre contest so he can afford fresh ingredients for his orphans' meals. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I was working on this script with Jared and Jerusha Hess. Jared directed Napoleon Dynamite, and they wrote that movie together. And the three of us got together, and, you know, Jared was really excited about writing a movie about Mexican luchadors for Jack. So we, you know, I don't know, we spent a few weeks in Salt Lake City and kind of came up with this story. It was one of the best sort of, or the most fun collaborative experiences I've had.
Let's hear a clip. Hear Jack Black as Ignacio. Has come upon a bunch of the orphans that he cares for wrestling, and Sister Encarnacion tells them they can't do this and wants Ignacio to explain to the kids why wrestling is bad.
Orphans, listen to me. Listen to Ignacio. I know it is fun to wrestle. A nice pile drive to the face, mm-hmm. or a punch to the face. But you cannot do it, because it is in the Bible not to wrestle your neighbor.
So you've never wrestled?
Me? No, come on. Don't be crazy. Listen, I know the wrestlers get all the fancy ladies, and the clothes, and the free creams and lotions. But my life is good. Really good. I get to wake up every morning at 5 a.m. and make some soup. It's the best. I love it. I get to lay in a bed by myself all of my life. It's fantastic.
And that is Jack Black as Ignacio in the film Nacho Libre, written by our guest Mike White. You know, this seems like an idea that really could miss. And, you know, you have, like, Jack Black here. He's, you know, has this accent. And was there ever any concern that you'd be seen as sort of showing the cultural sensitivity of the Frito Bandito?
Well, I mean, because the idea came to me through Jared, I was concerned, and certainly Jack was concerned about all of that. But, you know, Jared is such a real deep fan of this world, and, you know, he's a Mormon and spent years in South America on his mission and speaks fluent Spanish and is just a real sort of like, you know, diehard fan of the luchador culture and South American cultures. And it just felt like it was coming from such a pure place, you know, even though his stuff is sort of twisted and like he does have a sort of absurd take on humanity. It didn't feel like it was sort of playing on stereotypes. It felt like there was just something more interesting about where the humor was coming from.
Well, you know, you're now a Hollywood triple threat, a successful writer, actor, and now director. Does acting more appeal to you?
You know, I just did a movie with Diane Keaton where I acted, and that was super fun because she's a friend of mine, and she's, you know, she's like a hero of mine, and that was fun. But, you know, it takes so much time to get the things that you are writing, you know, manifested that it's hard for me to warrant walking away from that for a few weeks to go act in something. I like acting, but if I was told I never could do it again, I could survive. But I don't think that's true about writing. I feel like if I'll always be writing, and that's kind of how I come to this business, I guess.
Well, Mike White, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, cool. Thanks for having me.
Actor, writer, and director Mike White. He's written and directed a new film starring Molly Shannon. It's called Year of the Dog. Here's Jack Black from the soundtrack of Nacho Libre.
Bien.
I am the singing at the party. I am singing, it's my turn to sing at the party. Everyone is dancing, happy party. But Ramses is not dancing, he does not dance at the parties. At night I play my games, I go to sleep, I think of Ramses. The people in the streets, they give him treats, they give him candy. Will he ever lose? We'll never know, he'll never find these. Ramses is the greatest, even though he runs with bandits.
What am I saying?
Ramses number one, he knows the secrets of desire. Ramses number one.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. And from Bonterra Vineyards, Mendocino, California, fine wines made with organically grown grapes and respect for the earth. Bonterra promotes responsible drinking. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the life and mind of Albert Einstein. Biographer Walter Isaacson says the 20th century's most celebrated scientist was late learning to talk as a baby and struggled with personal relationships as an adult, but had a unique way of posing questions about the natural world. Isaacson's new book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. Join us for the next Fresh Air.